It is felony child abuse for a parent or any other person providing care to or supervision of a child less than 16 years of age to allow the commission of a sexual act upon the child. Addressing an issue of first impression, the Court of Appeals recently held the phrase allows the commission of any sexual act to mean a parent, one, has actual knowledge that a sexual act on the child has occurred or is occurring, two, has the capacity to prevent further sexual acts, and three, fails to take reasonable action to protect the child. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Kleist, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
So, Joe, I think that felony child abuse case also found insufficient evidence of aiding and abetting when there was some question about what the parent knew and when. Tell us about State versus Kleist.
State v. Kleist. This was a case out of Cleveland County involving just horrible facts. Back in December of 2020, defendant Lipscomb lived with her boyfriend, defendant Kleist, and her two children, called in the opinion Val and Luke, in a camper in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. Val was 7 years old, and Luke was 9 years old. There was some indication in the opinion that the camper that they lived in was essentially uninhabitable, falling apart. It had broken windows. There was no running water. At some point, defendant Kleist, that is the boyfriend, molested the children. Kleist forced Luke to touch his penis, performed oral sex on him, and anally penetrated him. Kleist penetrated Val's vagina and anus with his penis, penetrated her anus with his finger and with a bottle, forced her to perform oral sex on him, and performed oral sex on her. There was evidence that defendant Lipscomb knew about Kleist's abuse of Val because Val told her about it, but the abuse continued. Kleist and Lipscomb were both indicted on multiple charges arising from the sexual abuse. Matter came on for trial in July of 2023. Luke and Val both testified about defendant Kleist's actions. There's an evidence issue here in this case. There was a nurse named Leanna Hill. Hill, who was admitted as an expert in forensic sexual assault examinations, testified that the children's physical examinations were normal, but this does not rule out sexual assault. She testified, consistent with her written report, that given the overwhelming fact that the majority of children who disclose sexual abuse have normal genital exams, the absence of injury on the examinations in no way lessens any concern for sexual abuse. Defendant Kleist was convicted of statutory rape of a child by an adult and two counts of statutory sexual offense with a child by an adult. Defendant Lipscomb, that is the mother, was convicted of aiding and abetting those crimes, statutory rape and statutory sex offense, and also two counts of felony child abuse by a sexual act. Both defendants appealed, and in a single opinion, the Court of Appeals addressed both of those defendants' arguments. There are basically three issues in the case. One was the sufficiency of the evidence of Lipscomb's aiding and abetting the three charges, statutory rape of a child and two counts of statutory sex offense. The second issue was the sufficiency of the evidence of Lipscomb's convictions of felony child abuse. And then the third issue raised by both defendants was whether the trial court erred at admitting Nurse Hill's testimony about whether the absence of injury is conclusive as to whether sexual assault occurred. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence of aiding and abetting, the Court of Appeals recognized that the elements of aiding and abetting are, one, that another person committed the crime, two, that the defendant knowingly advised, instigated, encouraged, procured, or aided, and three, that the defendant's actions or statements caused or contributed to the crime's commission. The Court of Appeals broke that down and said that aiding and abetting has both what it called a conduct requirement and also a mental state requirement. The conduct requirement demands some form of assistance, encouragement, or other supportive behavior. The mental state requirement demands that the defendant knew that the perpetrator was committing the crime and intended to facilitate the perpetrator's unlawful purpose. Here, the Court of Appeals found insufficient evidence of supportive behavior by defendant Lipscomb. There was no evidence she witnessed the abuse. Neither victim indicated that Lipscomb actively encouraged Kleist or communicated an intent to assist, and it said her physical presence in the home without more was not enough. The Court of Appeals also found insufficient evidence of that culpable mental state by defendant Lipscomb. The state failed to show that Lipscomb knew Kleist was committing a crime against Luke. Even if Lipscomb knew, the state failed to show that she intended to facilitate Kleist's crimes. The Court of Appeals rejected the state's reliance on the parent's special duty to his or her children. It distinguished the state's case law as all involving parents who actually witnessed the abuse but failed to intervene. And it pointed out that the state failed to request an instruction about a parent's special duty to his or her children. The Court of Appeals concluded that the state failed to present sufficient evidence that defendant Lipscomb aided and abetted defendant Kleist in committing statutory rape or statutory sex offense with a child by an adult. And then turning to that second issue of the sufficiency of the evidence of the two counts of felony child abuse, there was one count of felony child abuse corresponding to each one of the two victims, so one for Val and one for Luke. Defendant Lipscomb argued that the evidence was insufficient to support two counts of felony child abuse. As I said in the introduction, any parent of a child less than 16 years of age who commits or allows the commission of a sexual act upon the child is guilty of a Class D felony. The Court of Appeals declared that the meaning of the term allows was an issue of first impression, and it concluded that a parent allows the commission of any sexual act under Section 14-318.4 when she, one, has actual knowledge that a sexual act on the child has occurred or is occurring, has the capacity to prevent further sexual acts, and fails to take reasonable action to protect the child, thereby letting such acts continue. It said defendant's physical presence during each act is not required. What matters is a knowledge and a failure to intervene. Here, the Court of Appeals said there was sufficient evidence that defendant Lipscomb committed felony child abuse with regard to Val. That arose from the fact that Val testified that she told defendant Lipscomb about defendant Kleist's conduct, but that the abuse continued. This, the Court of Appeals said, shows that Lipscomb had actual knowledge of the abuse. Lipscomb had the capacity to intervene, but there was no evidence that Lipscomb took any action to protect Val.
You know, Joe, it seems to me that some of the prosecutors listening to this are going to find it, it seems like a little bit of a disconnect that the logic and the rationale we're applying to the child abuse case would not apply the same way to these other sex offense charges against him. I understand the issue that we're talking about on those first sets of charges with the mental state requirement. You know, they're pointing out that looking at the record, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that this defendant Lipscomb knew about the abuse against Luke. But there is evidence in the light most favorable to the state that at least the defendant did know about the abuse that was being committed against Val. But then they say, even so, the state presented no evidence of affirmative conduct by Lipscomb actively encouraging or communicating intent to help Kleist commit these offenses against Val. Viewed in the light of sort of how we analyze the child abuse, it's cognitively a little hard to wrap right. Your head around why that isn't enough to count as, you know, assistance, encouragement, or other supportive behavior. If you know this abuse has been going on and then you're going to just leave the children in that same dangerous environment with a dangerous person, and yet, you know, evidently that's not enough for those charges to count as encouraging or assisting.
Yeah, this is how they distinguish the aiding and abetting from the felony child abuse. And I think that argument is one that the defendant advanced before the Court of Appeals. It basically, like, the fact that the state presented no direct evidence that she knew about the abuse of Luke meant that all of these charges should go away. And the Court of Appeals kind of split that a little more carefully and said, well, for the aiding and abetting, you have to have this positive encouragement, whereas for the felony child abuse, it was sufficient that she knew about it and failed to intervene. I think to make sense of that, the Court of Appeals did point out that the state failed to request an instruction on a parent's special duty of care. And for the Court of Appeals, that was an important element for why the evidence was not sufficient to show this aiding and abetting, that the state didn't advance this theory that the parent should have known and should have intervened. So maybe the lesson to take away there is when you have a situation like this involving a defendant who is a parent or a caretaker, maybe the prosecutor could push that theory of the parent's special duty, request an instruction on the parent's special duty. And I think if another scenario like this were to come along, that might be a way to distinguish this case. But you're certainly right. In this case, the Court of Appeals found insufficient evidence of aiding and abetting. So the mother is essentially off the hook for defendant Kleist's sexual offense and rape of the children. She is not off the hook for felony child abuse, at least with regard to the child who had told her about the sexual abuse and she failed to intervene. But then to close that loop, the Court of Appeals went on to say there was insufficient evidence of felony child abuse about the child who apparently did not tell her. It said there was insufficient evidence defendant Lipscomb committed felony child abuse with regard to the victim, Luke. There was no evidence Lipscomb knew about the sexual assault on Luke. Luke testified that he never told her. And without evidence that Lipscomb knew that defendant Kleist committed sexual assault on Luke, she could not have allowed them under the felony child abuse statute. Again, there was, I think the state presented a plausible argument here. Look, you're talking about a camper where you can see from one end of the enclosure to another. How could she not know that this was going on? But when it gets to the Court of Appeals, They're looking very granularly at the testimony that the victims gave. Luke testified that he didn't tell mom about the sexual abuse. Apparently, the prosecutor didn't elicit other evidence from which it could be inferred that the mother could not have avoided knowledge of that conduct.
And, you know, Joe, we don't know all the facts of this case, but maybe that's our takeaway for the prosecutors, right?
Yeah.
Is what, obviously, these defendants are not testifying in this case. We've only got the children and they're just relaying what they did or didn't tell to the other parent. But is there something maybe we could draw out that would, you know, make it obvious or, you know, circumstantial evidence of the knowledge?
Yeah. And to be careful about that, right? The statute as construed by the Court of Appeals requires actual knowledge. It's not going to be enough that the defendant should have known.
Sure.
But I think the more evidence you can draw out of a victim about, you know, the size of the trailer, the circumstances of the abuse, where was mom when this happened? Is there any way that she could not have known otherwise that this sexual abuse was going on? It's going to be easier to make the argument that there is at least evidence from which her knowledge can be inferred. And then finally, to reach that last issue, the third issue, both defendants argued that the trial court plainly erred by admitting Nurse Hill's testimony that the absence of physical injuries should not lessen any concern for sexual abuse. The Court of Appeals recognized a North Carolina Supreme Court case called State v. Stansel from 2002, holding that in a child sex case, absent physical evidence of sexual abuse, the trial court errs by admitting expert opinion that sexual abuse has in fact occurred. Here, the Court of Appeals found no violation of Stansel. It said Nurse Hill never opined that Val or Luke was actually abused. She said only that the absence of injuries neither proves nor disproves the abuse. Nurse Hill explained that children's bodies heal quickly after genital injury, making the absence of injuries medically inconclusive. And then the Court of Appeals said, quote, this scientific explanation distinguishes this case from situations where experts offer bare conclusions without a medical basis. So it actually turned back and relied to some extent on the fact that this was an expert and that she had expertise in this area and could opine on it, even though she did not say that sexual abuse necessarily occurred in this case. The Court of Appeals went on to say, even if admission of Nurse Hill's testimony was erred, the defendants could not show prejudice. Both victims testified about defendants Kleist's abuse, and their accounts were corroborated by evidence of their outcries to family members and behavioral changes observed by multiple witnesses. So ultimately, there was no plain error in the admission of that expert opinion, but the Court of Appeals did overturn several of the convictions of defendant Lipscomb for insufficiency of the evidence. And then I think the second case we had on for today was State v. Allen.
It is, Joe. But before I get to State v. Allen, I just wanted to flag one other case out of this December 3rd set for some of the prosecutors. You know, we try to keep it to two or three cases for the sake of time. I am going to focus on Allen, but I just wanted to mention this other case, State versus Mitchell from December 3rd, was another one that I think may be of interest to some prosecutors. This was primarily a drug-based offenses that were at issue in the case, and it turned on essentially a consent search of a property where some people are living without the homeowner's permission. So he calls on law enforcement to go into the house and try to get the people out of the home. And what happens when they get inside the house is that they are placing the defendant under arrest for an outstanding warrant, but they are also seeing what they say they instantly saw copious drug paraphernalia in plain view and end up finding other drugs. And the issue in the case is that after placing handcuffs on this defendant, they then ask him, because there's numerous people that are in the home at the time, they then ask him who lives here. And the case just sort of caught my eye a little bit because I know for most of us, that would not really feel like a custodial interrogation, that just right in the moment of trying to secure the scene and begin looking around, asking a simple question like that. So who lives here? But, you know, in a case like this, where it's going to be all about who is in constructive possession of these drugs that are being found in the home, who lives here actually is a pretty significant question that's being asked. And so it ended up being an issue in terms of Miranda. So, you know, whether he should have been advised of his rights and whether they were committing a custodial interrogation of him. So especially for prosecutors that work on those kind of cases, not going to spend a lot of time on it, but would encourage you to take a look at State versus Mitchell. But yes, the one I wanted to focus on out of this set was State versus Allen. This is, again, one from December 3rd, a case originally out of Forsyth County. And what the facts are involving is a shooting that happens in Winston-Salem back in March of 2022 near a restaurant called Kermit's Hot Dog. There are 11 shots that are fired from a 9mm and a 45 caliber. There's some serious injuries to several victims and damage to the restaurant. These two defendants, Defendant Allen and another defendant, Rush, were observed getting into this blue Hyundai vehicle with a couple of other people nearby. Rush is the driver. Alan is the rear passenger seat. 6 minutes later, they drive by this Kermit's restaurant, and there's camera footage that shows the vehicles passing by the restaurant just before and just after the time of the shooting. So several people are hit. They suffer serious injuries. After the shooting, these two defendants, Rush and Alan, split up and go separate ways. One of them is located in a different vehicle. The blue Hyundai is later found abandoned behind a vacant residence. There's abundant evidence tying these two defendants to the crime. There's forensic evidence like fingerprints that are found on the Hyundai. Weapons are recovered, forensic evidence like that. But part of the state's evidence also involved phone records from the two defendants. And based on the phone records that were obtained, they had a CAST report prepared by FBI Special Agent Putman. Agent Putman prepared a CAST report, that is a cellular analysis survey team, which essentially illustrates where the cell towers are in the nearby location and maps that up to the data recovered from the phones, putting them at various points around the map. In the report that Agent Putnam originally prepared, it did not necessarily show that any of these cell towers that were accessed or used by Allen's T-Mobile phone or Rush's AT&T phone were right there in the service area around the Kermit's hot dog on the day of the shooting. Or I should say, didn't indicate that they had ever initiated cell service in that nearby area. But interestingly, at trial, the agent testified to what they're calling a new opinion, something that was not contained in the original report, and they say that he formed this opinion on the sixth day of trial. And essentially what the agent was saying is that reviewing further data in these phone reports, he looked at what is called handoff data between these cell towers and explained that based on that, there were indicators that it was likely these towers had provided coverage to the phones in these area based on the handoff data from the service providers. And the agent acknowledged in his testimony, he said this data can be unreliable, but he testified that some of the data is reliable, even if some of it is not. And through his training and experience, he's able to tell the difference. And based on that, he did think there was handoff data indicating that those phones could have been in this location. The defense is objecting to this, primarily saying, well, we never got the handoff data in the discovery that was given to us. So they sort of sort that out over the lunch recess. They're told to go, you know, dig a little deeper into the pile of data that you were given. When they come back, they are able to verify that, yes, that data was actually provided. So they cross-examine the witness about the new opinion that he's given, and ultimately both defendants are convicted of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, and seven counts of discharging a firearm into occupied property. So, as you can imagine, both defendants are arguing that the trial court erred by admitting this expert testimony about the historical cell site handoff analysis, and also arguing that there's a discovery violation in terms of the state sandbagging some of this data that was provided to them for trial. So to address that, the court walks through initially, all right, let's talk about the expert opinion. Does it satisfy the requirements under Rule 702 to be admitted as a proper expert opinion? They talk about how under Rule 702A, there's this three-step framework. We have to look at the, you know, the qualifications, the training, knowledge, experience of the person who's offering the opinion, the relevance of that to the case at hand, and the reliability of the expert testimony. Was it reliably applied to the facts of this particular case? And on all three of those, they have little difficulty in saying yes, that the witness was qualified. He described his specialized knowledge, experience, training, education, and CAST methodology, and explained how historical cell detail and tower relation records are created, how they're used, how they're interpreted for forensic purposes. So he is certainly a qualified witness to give this. They also say the data underlying the analysis, like these tower usage records and the corresponding GPS coordinates, all those they recognize are standard sources that are used in historical cell site analysis nationwide. So yes, these are reliable principles and methods, and they were reliably applied to the facts of this case. You know, the agent testified he didn't just plug it into some computer and have it plotted out. The agent testified that he was independently auditing each plotted point, not just relying on some kind of software output. And he also explained to the jury, you know, there are limitations to this data I'm talking about, especially the second opinion with the handoff data, but explained why it is reliable in some ways and in other reasons why it's not. But, you know, this is the kind of data that the company uses for their own internal purposes about billing and ensuring reliable coverage and all of that. And based on his training and experience, he could look at the individual points that were being plotted audit and vouch for the reliability of that. So it satisfied all aspects of Rule 702. So it was proper to admit that opinion. Now, the issue that the defense is arguing really comes down to this sort of discovery violation question. What they were objecting to at trial really had more to do, Joe, I would say, with the underlying data itself. That's the objection, is that when the witness gets back on the stand and starts talking about handoff data, they're objecting, saying, what are you talking about? What is this handoff data? That wasn't in the opinion. We never got that. We don't know anything about that. And as I said, they take a break over the lunch recess. The judge tells them to go back and look a little more closely at what the state provided. And it says, upon returning, defense counsel stated that they were asked to verify whether the data was in the discovery that the state provided. It is in there. And the trial court then asked, is there anything further? And defense counsel said, no, Your Honor. That's sort of the point I wanted to highlight, is the objection they're making is really about the disclosure of the underlying data of this, the handoff data that the expert is testifying from. It's not really an objection then to the opinion that the expert was giving, which was something quite different than what was in the original point. You know,
yeah, that's my concern here, Jonathan. I mean, because is there any indication in the opinion of why it took the expert until halfway through trial to come up with this opinion? It doesn't sound like a situation where the prosecutor knew about this and just intentionally withheld it. This was a situation where the witness didn't come up with this opinion until we're halfway through the proceeding. Like, how does that happen?
What we know from the opinion, Joe, it says that the expert report indicated neither of defendants' phones had initiated cell site service in the area around Kermit's Hot Dog Restaurant on the day of the shooting. At trial, Agent Putman testified to a new opinion, not contained in his original written report, which he had formed on the sixth day of trial. At least based on this, it does appear to be a genuinely new opinion that the expert is coming to as he, you know, attends trial and hears things, thinks about it further or what have you. But so it was not, the opinion was not something that was disclosed, even though the underlying data was in there. And I mean, as far as I can tell, I mean, I didn't try the case. We don't have the report or the full transcript, but it seems like it's exactly what you're saying, that it's mid-trial. The expert says, wait a minute, there's something else I could look at, goes to look at it and says, you know what? Look down here. There actually are some indications in the phone records that they were at this location. And so he's providing that information to the jury. So here the court is saying there was not a discovery violation and there does not appear to be a second objection to the expert giving the opinion itself as some kind of a discovery issue. And that's really what sets up the final issue in the case is, I think then on appeal, they're saying, all right, well then the failure to object to this new opinion, surely that would be ineffective assistance of counsel. I mean, you know, that they should have prevented him from getting into that. But the Court of Appeals looks at that and says, we don't see that as being ineffective assistance of counsel either. They talk about, you know, of course, the two-prong test that has to be satisfied under Strickland v. Washington about whether defense counsel's conduct fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and then whether the defendant can show that the defendant was the deficient performance prejudiced the defense. And they don't see that here. The Court of Appeals looking at it does not see conduct from the defense attorney falling below an objective standard of reasonable performance because, frankly, they did a really good job on cross-examination. The court talks about that more than once, about how these defense attorneys clearly had a good grasp of the cell site data. They understood what it meant. They're asking probing questions on cross-examination. And so, you know, that's really a trial strategy decision that could be made. Do I want to just try to keep it out, or do I want to pick him apart on cross and point out all the things that he can't show or that he doesn't know or that isn't certain? And so that was a reasonable way for them to approach it. And then on top of that, even if it were error to let it in, the defendant is failing to show any kind of prejudice because we didn't go into extensive detail about it, but there is substantial other evidence of their guilt.
You know, they say overwhelming evidence, don't they?
Overwhelming evidence. They've got the camera footage putting him in the Hyundai. They've got the fingerprints. They've got the guns. They ballistic. You know, all this other evidence indicating that clearly these were the two, and the phones were just, you know, added onto the pile with the information from the phone record. So anyway, I guess that would sort of be my big takeaway for prosecutors about this one is, yes, it seemed like it worked here. And of course, in a case like this, if your expert really does have some kind of a realization mid-trial of, wait, there's something else here that we should talk about, well, then we should certainly offer that if we can. But this could have gone a different way had there been a proper objection from the defense saying, well, that is a brand new opinion. In many ways, the exact opposite of the opinion we were provided, right? Saying there's nothing in the phone records putting him on site to there is something in the phone records.
Yeah,
putting
and
him
I'm
on
wondering
site.
Whether it might be appropriate when you've got a situation where an expert comes forward and say, look, I've combed through all this data. There doesn't seem to be anything to suggest they were in the area. If the prosecutor might gently suggest, can you go back and look again? Can you make sure that we don't have something like this historic handoff data that maybe, because obviously it's beneficial for, to the state's case to say your cell data puts you in the area of the offense. And for a witness to, first to testify no, and then, oh, I changed my mind. I don't think there's any indication here that there's no whiff of misconduct by the prosecutor, but it does begin to look a little fishy if your expert witness changes his opinion at, you know, 180 degrees mid-trial.
I would agree with that. And I think you're right. I mean, that was sort of the terminology that was being thrown around, I think, by the defense. This is, you know, sandbagging in the discovery, right? We're burying it and then springing a surprise. And I would agree with you. And I think that's probably how the court is looking at it. And there's no indication, as far as I can tell, that anything like that happened. It was just something that the expert realized, as they say, on the sixth day of trial, hey, wait, there's some other data we could look at. And here's what that indicates. But I would agree with you. Certainly, if we could figure that out ahead of time, that would be a whole lot better. If it's not possible, then I think we want to make those points that you're raising, right? This is not intentional. It's not sandbagging. It's not a discovery violation. Anytime we're talking about discovery, I'd refer people to, what is it, State v. Mahatha, I think was a recent case on that. Even if there is a discovery violation, there's a spectrum of remedies that the court can look at under 15A903 that, I mean, it doesn't mean it necessarily has to be excluded, right? We could... Well, then what do you need? Do you need an hour recess to look through the data yourself and figure something out? Or, you know, what? There's a range of options the court could consider short of just totally blocking it. So that would be something else to be ready to argue if you have this kind of surprise opinion that comes up. And then, Joe, I think the last opinion that we wanted to talk about, a shorter one, is State versus McCoy.
Yeah, State v. McCoy. This is a case out of New Hanover County. It's a relatively short opinion from the Court of Appeals, only about 3 pages, and we get not much factual information about the circumstances, but the procedural history. In late 2023, defendant was indicted on 25 charges, including 14 drug charges. At trial, the trial court instructed the jury on the charge of felony possession of a Schedule 6 controlled substance, that is marijuana. It said the state must prove defendant knowingly possessed marijuana. Omitted from that instruction was any requirement that the jury find the amount. Defendant was convicted of 8 charges, including felony possession of marijuana, and then appealed. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued the trial court erred by entering judgment on felony possession of marijuana when the jury was instructed only on misdemeanor possession of marijuana. In North Carolina, of course, marijuana is a Schedule 6 controlled substance. Simple possession is a Class 3 misdemeanor. Possession of more than 1.5 ounces of marijuana is a Class I felony. But there is case law that recognizes that to get to that felony conviction, the jury has to find that the defendant possessed more than 1.5 ounces. In this case, the amount of the drugs is an element of the offense. The Court of Appeals here looked at an older North Carolina Supreme Court case called State v. Gooch. That's a case from 1982. Gooch is one of the cases that held that the felony amount is an element of the offense and that the trial court errs by failing to instruct the jury on that element. What happened in Gooch, as the trial court did here, it omitted that element, and the Supreme Court in Gooch said that by failing to submit the felony amount element, the trial court essentially submitted the offense of simple possession, and the jury convicted the defendant of that offense. So in Gooch, it remanded for entry of judgment on the misdemeanor amount. The Court of Appeals in this case noted that a party generally may not raise error in the jury instructions absent an objection below. It noted that here the defendant did not challenge the jury instruction. Rather, he alleged that there was error in the sentence, basically that the trial court erred in entering judgment on the felony when essentially the instruction allowed the jury to convict him only of the misdemeanor. The Court of Appeals said here, as in Gooch, the trial court failed to instruct that the state had to prove the defendant possessed more than 1.5 ounces of marijuana. As in Gooch, in failing to submit the amount requirement, the trial court essentially submitted simple possession of marijuana, and the jury convicted the defendant of that offense. The Court of Appeals concluded that the trial court erred by sentencing the defendant for felony possession of marijuana, and it vacated the conviction and remanded for resentencing. The reason this case is particularly interesting to me is I think this could have come out a different way. Basically, when a defendant argues a jury instruction on appeal, if the appellate court finds error in the jury instruction that is prejudicial, typically the remedy is a new trial. That's not what happened here. What happened here was the trial court inadvertently omitted an element of this offense. And the Court of Appeals said that meant that the trial court essentially acquitted the defendant of the felony by submitting only the misdemeanor. And the Court of Appeals was going to construe the verdict for what it was and send it back for misdemeanor sentencing. Now, the double jeopardy cases recognize that typically a dismissal is not an acquittal unless it is a deliberate decision that the evidence of the greater offense is insufficient as a matter of law. What's significant is that neither in Gooch nor in McCoy is there any discussion as to what evidence there was of the felony amount. They treat that as irrelevant, that the trial court basically, by making this mistake in the instructions, submitted only the lesser included and effectively acquitted the defendant of the greater offense.
You know, Joe, I think you sort of made a good point that we don't get a ton of facts for this. They're really just focused on the procedural angle of it. The state, evidently on appeal, was arguing this unpublished case, State versus Davis, where there was evidence that was actually presented at plea to establish what the amount was. The court rejects that. Hey, that's an unpublished case. That's not binding on us. Regardless of any evidence adduced at trial, the defendant possessed more than 1.5 ounces of marijuana. Failing to submit the amount requirement, as discussed above, the trial court essentially submitted to the jury the offense of simple possession of marijuana. In other words, there may have been evidence that was submitted to the jury in this case that we've got way more than 1.5 ounces. That we have more than enough to make it the felony charge. And so, I mean, you know, we've got potentially, at least, we've got evidence submitted to the jury that would support it. For all we know, they may have returned a verdict of guilty on that had they been instructed on it and given the choice between the options. We really just don't know. But because of the way it was submitted, they're saying, that's it. You know, they were given this one charge. That's the only thing he can be convicted of. That's what we're going to remand it back down for versus just, as you say, well, how about a new trial with proper instructions? And then we can decide which it is.
It's interesting to me, the sort of appellate advocacy angle here. There are three different ways that this could have been argued. The defendant could have challenged the jury instructions. He didn't do that. He could have challenged the sufficiency of the evidence of the amount. Didn't do that, which at least suggests that there was sufficient evidence of the amount. What the defendant did here was say there was a variance basically between the instruction and the judgment that was entered. And the Court of Appeals, looking at this older case, Gooch, went with that argument and said, you're right. When the trial court failed to submit this felony amount, it basically acquitted him of the greater offense. The jury convicted him of the lesser included. And so that's the only offense that the judgment will support. Moving forward, I guess the lesson for prosecutors is, now I understand this was a very, look, there were 25 charges. I imagine the jury instruction must have been very long. A prosecutor in a case like this where you have a greater offense with all these potential lesser includeds needs to listen carefully to the jury instruction because you don't want to end up with an inadvertent acquittal of the greater offense merely by a failure of the trial court to instruct on all the elements of the greater offense.
Yeah, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, for a case like this, where he's convicted as well with PWISD and sale or deliver of a controlled substance, possession of Schedule II controlled substance, cocaine, possession of stolen firearm, fleeing to elude arrest, hit and run. I mean, I understand the possession of marijuana may not be the one that's most catching your eye as a prosecutor, but to the extent you can, keeping an ear out to make sure we've got all those elements listed there.
Not a huge win for the defendant, but the principle, I think, is really interesting. And the possibility that the trial court might inadvertently acquit your defendant is one that prosecutors need to look out for.
Absolutely.
Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Kleist, finding insufficient evidence of aiding and abetting child sex crimes and felony child abuse. State v. Allen, concluding the trial court did not err by admitting expert testimony on historical cell site handoff analysis. And State v. McCoy, holding the trial court erred by sentencing the defendant for felony possession of marijuana when the trial court instructed the jury only on misdemeanor possession of marijuana. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.